Hey everyone, welcome to Web Culture and WMR.fm. It's the 24th of it's the 24th of March, 2022. I will get my dates right, especially since it's 1 month since the illegal invasion of Ukraine began. And interestingly, we have in the green room waiting to join us in an interview, we have Ted Harrington, a cybersecurity expert. And one of the people you might think of when you hear the term ethical hacker. We'll let you all think about that for a few minutes. Couple of fairly major things happened in the search world over the last week, as they will. There's a products review update that's in a mega long rollout. This is going to be like 3 weeks before it's done.
Yep.
So what we know about it so far, and I'm admittedly getting most of what we know from our friend and hero Barry Schwartz over at SE Roundtable. It's going to take about 3 weeks to fully go through. It's looking at and reviewing the content that you have around products. And this is both the content that you generate and user-generated content. It's not going to penalize, but it will reward. And as Dave's fond of saying, if your competition gets rewarded, you've effectively gotten penalized. It's not a core update. It's English language only currently, but that's going to change over time. It's a global update, a global launch. So it'll be hitting multiple languages over time. But right now, it's English only. If you get hit by it, if you need to recover, rewrite your content. That's Google's advice. And they're going to refresh this part of their algorithm a number of times in the future. This isn't a full algorithm update or anything of the sort, but they're updating a piece of the algorithm. Do you ever get concerned about stuff like this, Dave, when Google rolls out an update?
You know, I used to get a lot more concerned when I was an affiliate marketer. You know, but yeah, I mean, anytime an update comes on, I always wait for that butterfly effect, right? It's like, it's meaning to do this, but this happens. It will be interesting to see if that effect hits e-com, but it seems like as much as anything can be, like a pretty straightforward update on their part, like what they're looking for. I don't think there's anybody in the listening audience other than affiliate marketers who just rip off people's content. I've been one. I'm not judging.
You know what? It's not that they rip it off on purpose. This is honestly, when you deal with like these mega e-com sites, it's what the distributors provide to you.
It's true.
You know, it's often in all caps too.
But you think what Google said, and they've said it from the beginning, provide an extra value. Right, like if I'm taking what the manufacturers provided me, no problem. It should probably be there. Specs are specs. But what other value? Otherwise, why is it not just Amazon? The question will be always, why is it not just Amazon for a product? And so you need to provide that extra value to sort of show that, or the manufacturer site, or any other website, right? So, I mean, it makes sense. I think the writing's been on the wall for like a decade that stuff like this was going to continue to roll out. This won't be
well, and the fact that Google does this every couple of months, you know. So if you lose ranking on this, it's not that you've lost ranking; it's that your competitors have gained ranking and you've just readjusted as they've risen. That's your indicator that you've got to work on content. And like Dave said, often it's manufacturers' content that you got to keep there because it's, you know, that's their specs, but you should rewrite the descriptions and stuff so you don't look like everybody else. Okay, we got a guest waiting. We got a couple more stories to go through. Google Analytics 4 is here to stay. Nothing's going to change it. We reported last week that it was rolling out. Everybody flipped out when Google announced that it was rolling out and replacing Universal Analytics. It's still rolling out to replace Universal Analytics a year from now, and all the freakouts you have aren't going to change that. What you can do is learn a lot more about it. Coming up in future episodes, we will have Alan Kanek and hopefully Donna DiTomaso, two analytics experts, to go through GA4. Google announced integration of GA4 and Search Ads 360. Is that going to confuse a lot of paid marketers, Dave?
Yes. But I mean, there's a gap, and it makes perfect sense that they're doing this because I think they're trying to give people this window. And so I don't think it'll really confuse people. There'll be the short term confusing, but I think it's to give people that lead time. Cause I think that the longer people have to double report and to really understand how things are changing, right? I'm spending a lot of the next 2 weeks going, okay, this is what's in Universal Analytics. And this is what I need to make sure that I can easily access, or anybody can easily access in reports, you know, over in GA4, things like that. I mean, this isn't related to that specific, you know, need, but I think that's basically what it boils down to, is just giving people enough time to sort of understand what they're doing. And you think of like a new user, somebody who's just launched their site, just launched their company. Yeah, do this. Don't even get them into Universal Analytics. Like, just, and good for them, right? just bypass that, because don't learn something you need to forget, you know, a year from now, or probably less. So, so yeah, I don't think it'll be a big confusion, but I do think it's good for them to let people get in there early.
Absolutely. And if you haven't already, Google is making it super easy to turn on Google Analytics 4, to initiate Google Analytics 4 from your Universal Analytics account. Look across the very top. There's a blue bar with a very handy, although slightly weird because it's also a blue button. Click the blue button. It's in the upper right-hand corner. It is blue on blue, but I swear to you it's there. And away you go. Once it's set up, it starts gathering data. It's not replacing Universal Analytics until July 2023, but get a year's worth of data there before Universal goes away, and you'll have some legacy stuff to deal with. Okay, we've got a guest waiting in the green room, and since we're using Zoom for our meetings, I can actually see him staring at us, waiting for us to get through. So I just want to get through the news now. We're done. Ted Harrington. Ted's an author of Hackable, How to Do Application Security Right. He's also the executive partner at Independent Security Evaluators, ISE, the company of ethical hackers, famous for hacking cars, medical devices, password managers, and stuff that you guys might have heard about in the news. He's helped hundreds of companies fix tens of thousands of security vulnerabilities, including Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Netflix, and others. We're going to press him on how secure Google is. He's probably not going to tell us half the stuff that we're going to want to know, but we're going to press him anyway. Ted Harrington has helped hundreds of companies fix thousands of vulnerabilities. Disney, Amazon, Google, Netflix, Adobe, Warner Brothers, Qualcomm, and others. He is probably one of the best known, quote unquote, ethical hackers. He leads a team that started and organizes IoT, Internet of Things Village, an event whose hacking contest is a three-time DEF CON Black Badge winner for discovering more than 300 zero-day vulnerabilities and counting. This is the guy who gets interviewed when media wants to talk about hacking and wants to try to understand the murky world that goes on behind the password screen. Ted Harrington, thank you so much for joining us here on Webcology.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We've been trying to arrange this time for over 6 weeks now. And back in that quaint time in the middle of February, when our worst concerns were maybe somebody was going to bust into my WordPress site, our conversation might have been actually, we have much larger concerns obviously than that, but most of our listeners are concerned about their own websites, maybe large e-coms for corporate clients. But I think the terms of cybersecurity have shifted rather dramatically in the last month. And that's kind of where I want to start. But before I do, could you introduce us to the concept of ethical hacking?
Sure. Yeah. And I would be very interested to explore the question that you started with after. So we should answer that question by first talking about what hacking is. So who is a hacker? What is a hacker? Because if the media is to be believed, you would think that a hacker is a malicious person associated in some way with wrongdoing. And that's only actually partly true, because what a hacker is neither good nor bad. A hacker is a problem solver. A hacker is somebody who looks at a system and understands how that system works and tries to determine, can this system behave differently than it was intended to behave originally? So if we think back to, like, way back in the day, that TV show MacGyver, where he could, you know, turn a paperclip into like a car key, or I actually never even watched the show, so I just only know the metaphor of MacGyver, but he's a hacker. He would look at things and say, oh, this thing, the paperclip is supposed to clip together paper, but can I make it become a detonator for a bomb, or whatever he would do. So that's what hackers do, right? They look at things and they say, it's supposed to do A. Can I make it do B instead? Now, the fork in the road comes to motivation. So the hackers that are out there who want to harm organizations, who want to gain personally in some way, but at the expense of someone else, those more malicious ones, those are the attackers. Those are the ones that the media is talking about when they say hacker, and they're talking about it in a negative sense. But the other side of the road, the other fork to the road, is people who come from my corner of the world, which are called ethical hackers. And ethical hackers, we also want to look at systems and see how they get broken. But we do that because we want to fix them. So that motivation is a very positive one. It's, you know, we'll do the exact same things the bad guys do. We're looking for those holes. We're looking for how you're going to abuse these systems, but the outcome is different. We're not trying to exploit the problem. We're trying to actually remediate or eliminate the problem entirely. So that's what ethical hacking is. Ethical hacking is basically, we're the good guy hackers, right? Companies will hire us to look at their software or their systems and say, how would an attacker break this? And then how do we make it better?
Okay, so you're a basically a cyber criminal who's not acting in criminal ways. You're going in, you're breaking stuff, you're documenting how it was broken, and then showing them how to fix it. And let me withdraw the cyber criminal part. I regret that. I regret that phrase.
Yeah, I was about to go to town on that. And the reason I say that is not because I actually understood the spirit of the question that you're asking. But that word is actually a powerful word.
Yeah, indeed.
And so many people, when they talk about hacker equals bad, they're saying hacker equals criminal. And
why do we first go there? Why are we so inclined to want to go there? Even though I know you're an ethical dude, I've before agreeing to have you on the show, I looked into you. You check out. So why is my head going there?
Well, probably because you've been conditioned by all the stories that you've read and everything, and you know what stories sell are more sensational ones. So ones that talk about, you know, hacker has really become this sort of scary, sort of sensational idea. But people who build things, people who build software systems, I mean, they call themselves hackers. Look at what's the address of Facebook? It's One Hacker Way,
indeed,
right?
So I think many SEOs who work to try to understand how Google functions, mm-hmm. and then you know affect their clients or their own websites to take advantage of Google's algorithms, they might consider themselves hackers as well.
I would argue they should consider themselves hackers, because what are they doing? They're looking at a system. They don't know how the system works. Because Google's not necessarily, you know, pulling back the curtain to say, here's how the algorithm works now. But they're looking at the system and saying, well, can I make it do something I want it to do on behalf of my customers or whatever? And that's what hackers do. And so in my context, you know, ethical hacker does mean a very specific thing, which is, you know, an entity or person or entity who tries to find out how a system will be broken in order to improve it. So that's a little bit different than an SEO, as you're describing, but it's the same spirit. How do you make a system do something differently than
indeed? I never claimed the word ethical was attached to the SEO hacking spirit. and to be honest, most SEOs know their way around a keyboard and very much understand how the internet works, but don't have the chops, skills, or knowledge that you or your team do. What is it you guys really, what kind of vulnerabilities are large Fortune 500 corporations or other organizations actually hiring y'all to find?
Well, they might not necessarily know what the vulnerability is that they're asking us to help them find. They just know that there are vulnerabilities. And so then our job is to go to determine not only what vulnerabilities exist, and also are they exploitable, which is like, that's an important difference, right? Having a weakness and being able to take advantage of the weakness are two different things. But then it's also helping them understand how bad it is, right? Because not all vulnerabilities are the same. So there's a few dials, I guess you could say, that sort of determine how severe a vulnerability is, but they're essentially boiled down to things like how easy or accessible is this problem, and that's one major dial. So if it's very hard to do or very hard to get to, then the severity comes down. If it's very easy to do, the severity is very high. And then the other is what would be the impact, right? So okay, let's say this problem is exploited. What happens if it's embarrassing? Maybe it's lower, but if it puts the company out of business, then obviously that's very significant. And the worst are when it's easy to do or very...
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Accessible to get to, and it has enormous impact, and you'd be surprised. That combination of things, that's where you have what's called a critical severity vulnerability. Those are actually pretty common. And those are the things that are the top of the priority list. Let's find the critical issues and get rid of those. Then we work on the highs, so on and so forth.
Now, when you're approaching a problem, this is part of the process that I've always really wondered about. When you're approaching, you don't know what you're going to find. They don't know what you're going to find necessarily, because if they did, they'd have fixed it already, right? Mm-hmm. So they're sending you in and going, show us what's wrong. In your experience, is the bigger hurdle on the technical? Like, clearly you have to have like technical chops. Like, you have to have like a library and then like of information in your head, and then a database of places to go to find new stuff. Mm-hmm. Or is it on the creative? How do I think about the problem in how to abuse what I'm looking at, right? Or like, and find the, I don't mean you abusing it, but finding those vulnerabilities, because you're having to put yourself into the black hat hacker's mind, mm-hmm. and go, how can I wreck this now? Yeah. So is it, do you find generally it's more a technical problem where you know the abuse, you just need to like somehow like force your way through and find that? Or is it, how do I think like that person? Mm-hmm. And how do I approach something I've never seen before and find out what to do?
Yeah, the uncertainty part is what makes it really exciting and dynamic, right? Knowing you go into a project and you don't know, like you have to be a problem solver. So let me use this metaphor to try to explain this. So let's say that we're experts on in automobiles and the braking systems, right? The system, you depress your foot on a pedal and it slows the car down. Although Tesla is changing the way braking systems work, but we're all familiar with that idea. So let's say I'm an expert at the braking systems for Japanese cars, for let's just say Toyota. And BMW, German car, says, hey, can you come help us evaluate our braking system? Or better yet, let's say Tesla. We have a brand new way to create braking systems in cars. You're a braking expert on Japanese cars. Can you come look at our system? It's totally different than anything you've ever seen. Will we be able to figure out how the vehicle slows itself down? Absolutely, because it's a systematic process. We know what we have to do in order to evaluate how does a system work. And once you understand how a system works, then you can look at how do you break a system. And that is where people who see the world the way that we see the world, which is not for everybody, I have to say. It is not. It's like for anyone who's ever seen the movie The Matrix, and they unplug from The Matrix, and it's like, it sucks. It's like all of a sudden it's this like dark world, and you're like, oh, I was kind of better in The Matrix. That's in a lot of ways what it's like to be a an ethical hacker or any type of hacker, because you're like, now all I see is the way the world can be broken. And so to put a very fine point on your question, Dave, it is a critical prerequisite that you need to be able to think like the attacker, and then you need to pair with it the technical capability to understand how to execute and implement that thought process.
So using the sort of problem you were addressing with, where, okay, now Elon's called you up and in you go, and you're sitting at Tesla, it is a different thing that you've dealt with before, right? Like, so I imagine you would have to pull in a grouping of people, somebody who's going to understand how the operating system of the Tesla car in general operates, somebody who ought, like, different levels of understanding about, this isn't something you've worked on necessarily. I know you probably couldn't tell me if you had, but how many people would you end up having to pull into a problem like that? Just rough estimate. How big does that scale have to be to provide that person, like to provide Elon with like a confident answer that yes, your brakes are safe, or no, but here's what you need to fix?
Yeah. So you're inherent in the question you're asking is a really, really, really important question that is often overlooked in cybersecurity. And the question is, how should companies who are building things collaborate with the security experts they hire to help them? And the answer to that is there should be a high degree of collaboration, high degree of information sharing. Yet the way that most people actually think about security is the opposite. What they want to do is they want to withhold information, right? So they'll say things like, well, the attacker doesn't know how the system works, so I'm not going to tell the security company I've hired to, you know, hack my system. I'm not going to tell them how the system works because the attacker doesn't know that stuff. But that's really, really bad, because that is an advantage that the defender has. The defender has the advantage of information, and by not sharing that advantage, you're actually setting yourself back. So it's not a good way to think about it. So now the answer for how many people need to be involved with information sharing, that depends really on the scope of a given system. And from our experience, as we're doing these types of projects, it's usually not that many people. You know, it's like, we need somebody who understands the architecture of the system. How's it built? Somebody who can explain to us the business use case, like, why does this system exist? Who's it for? What do the users care about? Who are the users? Those kinds of things. How do we make money? It can be even one person who can share all of these things. And then it's on us to know how to ask the right questions to be able to get to the heart of the matter. But rarely is it like we need the whole company involved. You know, it's usually a small number of people. They walk us through how the system works, and then we're off to the races from there.
So you don't actually need all hands on deck. You don't need a representative from all departments to be involved to ensure corporate security. Something you said earlier about your clients not necessarily giving you full information made me think that there's people you need to give information to: your accountant, your lawyer, your doctor, your cybersecurity expert. And this is a very general question for sure, but how insecure is corporate North America?
Not to put too fine a point on it. How bad is it?
Well, I mean, again, it's hard to phrase that question without asking really generally and then going into specifics.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is a general question, but it's an important one. And the answer to it has two answers, or two parts of the answer, and they're going to sound like they contradict. So the first part is things are getting better, and the second part is things are getting worse. So what I mean by things are getting
better. Is this a game of cat and mouse?
Yeah. It's like, Ted, can you just give me a straight answer? Like, I'm asking a straightforward question. But they're two different topics, and the question is, how do they intersect? So things are getting better. By this, what I mean is that the way that companies today think about security is vastly better than they thought about it 15 or 20 years ago. That there's a significant improvement in the way that organizations think about security, the way they're investing in security, the way they're building security teams. That's a really, really positive thing that we're moving in the right direction. But it's although that's getting better, the things that are getting worse at maybe a bigger rate. And that's things like the rate at which technology changes, the rate at which the attackers change, the rate at which we are relentlessly moving to adopt technology across all aspects of the business. So these things inherently weaken the security posture, even though we're getting better at it. So it's sort of like we're making progress, but we're not making progress fast enough.
Well, yeah, what I meant to ask is it a game of cat and mouse between the hackers, the bad hackers, the evildoers, and the security experts? You patch one hole, and the bad guys find five more.
Yeah, I like to think of it as an arms race, and both sides are continually getting better, improving skills, developing new techniques, new tools. Defenses are improving. And the attackers are inventing new techniques. So it's one of these things where people sometimes want to think about security as a thing that can be done, right? Like, oh, I did my security this year and now I can chill. That's like an Olympian being like, I ran my wind sprints this month and I can wait until the games now. And it's like, no, you constantly have to be getting better because your opponents are constantly getting better. Every day, someone is trying to outwork you. And that's the way we need to think about security. It truly is an arms race. And so even though it's close to the idea of cat and mouse, I think it's a little more inspirational because really it helps us understand the game that we're in. The game that we're in is we are against very dedicated, very sophisticated, very motivated opponents. And so that has to influence the way that we think about, the way that we approach, and the way that we invest time, effort, money, and other resources in solving this problem.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
So I've been trying to think of a question that I could ask that could get my gauge my feel for how confident you are in who's winning this battle. Is it actually getting better or is it actually getting worse? And I think I've got it. If Elon could come to you and say, this vehicle 100% drives according to all the rules, you are safe in it. Mm-hmm. But knowing the vulnerabilities as you do that could possibly exist, would you hop in that vehicle right now and feel safe driving around in an autonomous vehicle, knowing that there's somebody out there trying to hack those brakes on you?
Yes, I would. I would feel comfortable doing that. Not because the vulnerabilities don't exist, but because inherently my profession is risk, is understanding risk and understanding what's acceptable. And most people, when they think about autonomous cars, they think about, well, it might get in an accident. And then you drive down any freeway and you look at all the other drivers and you're like, those are the things I'm worried about. Other idiots on the road. So someone hacking my car, yeah, that's a legitimate thing. And I think especially people who have a target maybe on their back, like should the president of the United States drive a self-driving car? Probably not, right? But should the average person who is not likely to get targeted, that's probably fine. Could there be a software failure in some way that results in an adverse outcome? Absolutely. But just the same way as there could be a mechanical failure, there could be issues with the road itself, with rain, there could be an earthquake and you fall into literally liquid hot magma. Like there, it's just not a, even though I was describing before this idea of like, you know, once you're a hacker, you're sort of unplugged from the matrix and you just see the bad in the world. And that is true, but you have to become comfortable with it. And I can accept that there is risk to the way that connected devices impact, especially transportation and especially delivery of healthcare. Those things really do alarm me. But the reason I'm okay with it is I see such passionate security professionals working on these problems in those fields.
But I would expect that in medical. I'd expect that in transportation, absolutely, or anywhere that hard goods are involved. But I don't necessarily believe that the guy who's making my fridge or my e-toaster or what have you, stuff that might have my credit card and banking information embedded in it so it can automatically order supplies when I need them. Part of your bio noted the IoT village. How secure is the new world that we're moving into, where we have smart appliances, smart kitchens, smart garages, etc.?
It's not great, and it's not great yet. Let's say it that way. I do believe that IoT is going really, really wonderful places. So what we need to realize is, let's think about the whole world of IoT and then maybe narrow in on how we should think about different segments to it. A lot of people, when they think about the Internet of Things, they think just about the consumer grade stuff, like the things you mentioned, the fridge, the toaster, or whatever. But it's really, IoT is any system that you can communicate with. So we just talked about cars. That's part of IoT. Medical devices are part of IoT. Even manufacturing lines that have all these sensors all over them, those are a subset of IoT. It's called operational technology. But your question was really about consumer grade electronics. And the way to think about that is probably this. The more expensive and the larger it is, the more that is able to be invested in security. So if it's larger, there's more space on the chipset that can be dedicated to security capability. And the more expensive it is, the easier it is to bake in the cost of security. When you go to the other end of the spectrum, you're talking about your, you know, maybe your light bulb or something. It is a little harder to implement security in those things. And so my personal take on it is that everyone, like all things in your life, you have to make the right risk reward trade-off. And so I like to look at things and say, well, is it worth having that connected thing because it does X, Y, or Z for my life, knowing that someone might be able to have access to my information if it gets stolen? And then that's how I make the decision. So for me, I'm not super interested in a lot of connected devices. So there's a lot of them I won't choose to have. For sure, I will not have a voice assistant. Like I do not want to put an active microphone in my house that is always listening.
You don't have Google Home or Alexa or a device like
no.
that? Okay, interesting.
When I visit my parents, they have them in every room and I will unplug them in the room that I'm in. And they're like, they get annoyed because I forget to plug it back in again when I leave. And they're like, why is it? Oh, because Ted is here. The thing doesn't work.
Why do you do that? What's your impulse to do that when you first walk in?
I mean, think about what we're doing with that, right? We're saying we're inviting a company to come listen to everything that we have to say. And they have their terms and conditions, right? That says, oh, we're only going to do this. We're not going to do with it. It's like, that's what you say, but I don't know. The only way to be sure that I'm not going to have that problem is if I, you know, unplug those. And so it's a great example of where I don't think that the benefit trade-off is high enough. Like when people are like, oh, you can just tell it to turn off the lights. I'm like, I'm standing next to the light switch. what is the benefit here? But other things like having connect like a smart lighting system, that's pretty cool to me. When the lights in the room change at certain times of day, they react to maybe what's on the TV. So there, that to me is, I'm like, the cool factor of that, I'm good with that.
Okay, and this is bringing up a really interesting topic to me, which is that sort of trade-off. And you've talked about it a few times now, that like, okay, I'm willing to sacrifice this, and a difference between you, who sees this, the matrix code all around, and have found it kind of depressing once it's lifted, actually a little bit from what I'm understanding, and the dark kind of gross world, and going, put me back in. Steak tastes better there. You know, versus your parents who haven't had that. And I'm a lay person. I haven't had that. Jim, our co-host, hasn't had that. What do people like us believe that we shouldn't? I mean, you're kind of stripping some of that away from me now. Thank you very much. I don't know whether I'm preferring this or not. I'm feeling a little unplugged, but still connected, and I can go back.
Yeah.
But yeah, what misconceptions do we have that probably we shouldn't about what's going on?
I think the biggest one is probably that each person feels this way about themselves. I'm not significant enough to be a target. And I want to say that's true. I want people to be like, okay, good. I don't have anything to worry about. I'm not a head of state. I'm not a head of a, you know, titan of industry or something like that. Attackers, they like the everyday person, because the everyday person, they're pretty easy to compromise, and they have social security numbers and ways to open up credit. And, you know, someone like taking a mortgage out in your name, that could really ruin you financially. Even if you were able to get the money back, the time and effort to, you know, to deal with that's a pain. So I think that's the big thing, is people who are a little more cavalier about their security because they think it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to them. They're like, I'm just some small person who does like whatever. I'm not, who cares? But people are not necessarily, those types of people are not necessarily targeted. Like, there's not a hacker, you know, of the evil type on some screen and, you know, pick your country around the world who's like, let me go find John Smith at, you know, 123 Main Street. But they're like, let me do this thing that targets hundreds of thousands of people. And then the, you know, 1 or 2% of them who fall for it, now I'm going to go destroy those people. And I mean, I'll tell you a perfect example. There's this scam that gets run on Craigslist for people who are looking for housing in really hot markets, like in Los Angeles or New York or San Francisco or wherever. And the scammers will create an ad that looks legitimate, and it looks like too good to be true. It's like a little bit less than market value or what the market rate would be. It's available right now. And what do you know? The people listing it are responding to you. They like you. They want to give it to you. But you have to wire them the security deposit and the first month's rent without seeing it, because it's so hot, they don't have time to show it to you. They're out of state. They're not going to be able to come back. And a lot of that plays on people's fear. And that's an example of where someone will think, well, I'm not going to be targeted, but hold on, things like this happen in your real life. And when you send that money, it's gone. The banks cannot get it back for you. That's, you know, you wire money, you're done. So yeah, that's the biggest misconception. People believe that they are not likely to be targeted. And that's unfortunately not true.
I heard, and I remember reading a weird stat that our consumer profiles are available on the dark web for, like, you know, pennies a profile. How easy is it for cyber criminals to take already known information about consumers? If you have a computer, chances are you got hacked years ago. I understand that to be true as well. How easy is it for the cyber criminals to circle the square here and actually commit identity theft with information that's already out there about many internet users?
I wouldn't say it's simple, but it's unfortunately not extraordinarily difficult. There are some significant hoops that identity thieves have to jump through. And the primary areas that are where the targets live or how these attacks are monetized typically go through our financial systems, and the financial systems are very aware of this, and they try to flag as many of these as they can. So for example, when you go to wire money through your bank, your bank will huge notices when before you click submit that says like, hey, do you know this person? Do you know, like, did you talk to him on the phone? Are you sure this is the right address? You cannot get this money back. And that's just an example I'm saying of where we know where the types of fraud lives. When people are trying to open up lines of credit, or I mentioned like mortgage before, the institutions that open these things, they want to make sure that they're lending it to the person who's creditworthy. So they have checks and balances. So it's actually an interesting system where the individual victim isn't able to look out for themselves. And it's not even necessarily the law enforcement's looking out for them. It's the purse strings. It's the financial institutions. They want to make sure the problem doesn't happen because they're going to eat it if it comes back to them through any sort of legal action. So that's a long way of saying that there are some significant hurdles to jump through. It's not like, hey, everybody go home and cry because your identity is going to get stolen. But there are some things that I would definitely recommend that everybody does. First and foremost, put a freeze on your credit. It's either very cheap or free to do. There's basically three major bureaus. It takes 10 minutes, maybe total, to do all three of them. You do it online. You don't have to call anybody. And what a credit freeze does is it basically says that nobody can take credit out in your name until that freeze is lifted. Now, that's a pain for you when you're like, oh, man, I wanted to get a car loan or open a new credit card or whatever. So you have to go lift the freeze. But you can rest assured knowing while the freeze is on that someone can't open credit in your name. So that is a major – that entirely thwarts this whole identity – or not all of the identity theft problem, but a significant part of it. And it's a very easy thing to do.
Amazing. We're running out of time. So I have 100 different questions I want to ask. How secure is the average home system? How easy would it be to get into the desktop that basically runs my business from my home?
Yeah, most are not very good, unfortunately. And that is just because the average person, it doesn't have these technical capabilities. Some of the devices that they might have deployed at their home environment, you can't change the credentials. I always feel like anything that you set up that connects to the internet should, by law, require you to change the credentials. I feel like that should be a law. Or if it's not a law, then at least it should be a best practice for the businesses, you know, not give you default credentials, or if it gives you default credentials, you have to change it right away. And the reason for that is that if people don't change the default credentials, that's like publicly available information, right? If you bought a router and it's like, you know, the password is, or the username is username and the password is password, well, an attacker knows that a lot of people aren't going to change that, and they can just go try that.
Isn't that how those the cyber perverts went after all those nanny cams? Because they have default credentials?
There's been a lot of stories about nanny cams and webcams getting compromised, and default credentials is one of the primary ways, yeah, because people don't change them or don't know to change them, or in some cases cannot change them. They're actually hard-coded.
Now, you'd mentioned listening devices, like a Google Home, for example, and I just want to circle back to that one because I sort of had a follow-up here as I'm looking at my phone sitting on my desk and go, what phone do you have? Like, how do you secure, like, it's a listening device. What do you do with your phone? And for people who want to like be secure on their phone without having this listening device sitting there.
Yeah. So there's a few pretty simple things to do. So first of all, whichever you have, Android OS or iOS, I would turn off the voice assistant. In terms of the active listening, so for example, on iPhone, you can say, hey Siri, or you can just hold a button and it does the exact same thing. But the difference is the microphone is not always listening to you if you have the voice activation turned off. You can still get the same exact benefit. Or if you have your headphones connected, you can pinch them and it goes right to like, hey, what do you want? And then you say what you need to say. So you still get all the benefits of the voice activation without the downside of the microphone always on. So that would be one thing. Second would be whatever biometrics are available, use them because they're effective security techniques and they're easy. So for example, Face ID. I look at my phone and it unlocks. And if I don't look at my phone or someone else is looking at the phone, it's locked. That's great. Like with the introduction, starting with the thumbprint, but now with Face ID, there is no reason for anybody to not have their phone locked. I mean, you actually have to go out of your way to make your phone vulnerable. That's dumb. So make sure that you have whatever biometrics installed. And then for every app that you have that offers it, use multi-factor authentication. So I know it sounds like a pain in the butt. You got to like get a text message or use an authenticator, but that technique is so ridiculously effective against stopping an attack because the attacker doesn't have your device. So the likelihood that they would have stolen your device and know your password is like, it's not even worth worrying about. And then the final thing that I would mention is use a password manager. So password managers allow you to use unique passwords for every service. They allow you to use very long, very complex, very difficult to say or remember or even type passwords. And they make your life easier because they all have browser plugins and everything. So you wind up getting, so each one of these things I just mentioned makes you significantly more secure while also in most cases making your life easier.
Now, something that I had heard, and you feel free to dispel this myth, and it relates to the biometric side of things that you're talking about. And one of the, I've never switched over, despite the convenience of it, because of the consideration of now being compelled. Like, i.e., if I am near my phone, anybody who can access me can now access my phone. You can just put my thumb on it, and now you're in. As opposed to requiring me to, you know, you might be able to force me to put in my password, but I have to do it because you don't have it. You can't just stick my thumb on my phone or put my face up. Am I just going, that's not happening, Dave? Like, border security isn't doing that to you. No criminal is doing that to you. You're far weaker with the vulnerability you're leaving open than the chances of that ever happening. Same reason you would get into a Tesla.
Yeah. Dave, I hate to pull you further out of the matrix here, but that scenario is just not realistic. Let's game out the scenario you talked about. Okay, so Dave, you don't have Face ID turned on, so someone can't compel you. The robber is standing there with a gun to your head, and you're like, I am not typing in my password. You're going to type in the password. So you having yourself as that intermediary layer, while in theory it's a good concept that you're getting at, like, let's add layers of defense, that I'm very pro. This particular use case is, I just can't see a scenario where it would actually help you.
Now, moving on to a different one, because you talked about a big vulnerability I think a lot of people have, and I like to think that my house is probably a little more secure than most because we have firewalls and things like that. But what's an affordable way? Like, if you couldn't show up at your parents' house and secure their house, which I'm sure you've done, like put in some stuff to help protect them, what would you tell them to do? Just some like basic things that any of our listeners can go, for $100, $200, I can dramatically improve, not bulletproof, but dramatically improve the security of my environment. Mm-hmm.
Well, definitely buy your own router. Don't use the router that the internet service provider gives you. It'll be also better. You'll get better performance. But they're just better. The security in the commercially available devices is better than the ones that the internet service provider gives you. If you're planning to install a lot of internet connected devices, which is today kind of becoming everything, like your thermostat, your TV, your, you know, everything's kind of becoming connected internet. You want to set up a different network for those than the network where you might have your tax return information and like your normal life. And that's pretty, I mean, just Google how to set up those separate segments. It's pretty straightforward to do. I think the average person can do it. It's not like you need to be an ethical hacker or anything. But I think the combination of those two is really pretty good. And then obviously doing all the basics that any security professional will rant about anytime about, like, you know, how to think about your passwords and all that kind of stuff. But start with those two, and I think you'd be in good shape.
Okay, we started the show with a serious question about national security. We're how vulnerable is our Western nations to hacking from Russia? That's I got to ask it the straight up question. Is it a concern, especially as the situation's getting tenser and tenser by the day?
Yeah, I mean, cybersecurity is the theater of war, just the same as sea, air, land, space. It's a realm where war is happening, and at the top of the show, you actually framed the question in a way that I forget exactly what your words were, but it was along the lines of, well, things are different now. And things are actually not different now. What's different now is that maybe people are noticing.
Okay.
But nations have been attacking each other via cyberspace for decades. The United States as well. I mean, we're not, you know, and we're not completely innocent in this. But innocence isn't actually the question, because it would, that would be like saying we're innocent because we don't have a military. It'd be like, no, that would be stupid to like not have something to protect yourself. So nations are constantly attacking each other. And what we are definitely going to see in our lifetime is as the new normal. And I'm surprised we haven't exactly seen it quite yet in the instances happening between Russia and Ukraine right now, but is the combination of a cyber attack paired with a more traditional sea, air, or land-based attack. Like, for example, an attack intended to immobilize first responders or something like that at the moment that a missile strike is, you know, landing. And this isn't me, the paranoid guy with a tinfoil hat in the corner, thinking this. Like, there are entire divisions, entire agencies in the United States government that are anticipating that type of combination attack and are, you know, fighting against it. I think it was Obama who first declared cyber as a theater of war. But this stuff is absolutely happening. It's happening during peacetime as well. All of the more developed nations, I should say, are constantly attacking each other, even in peacetime, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to establish a foothold in each other's systems in the event that they need to now take these, you know, maybe you might call them sleeper cells, right? These this position in their now enemies' networks or whatever, and activate them in an attack. So yeah, this has been underway for a very, very long time. The difference is just people are starting to notice it now, because Russia is actually very, very good at cyber attack. And the major nations are, I mean, Russia's excellent at it. United States, China. I mean, this is definitely happening.
Maybe a good question to ask might be, how good are we at cyber defense? If Russia's really good at cyber attacks, how good are we at cyber defense?
Well, that's a difficult one for me to answer for a number of reasons. One, because I don't have all the information, and two, because I'm, you know, more inclined to speak objectively in terms of data. But what I can say more subjectively is that I think we're doing a decent job based on the fact that our entire critical infrastructure hasn't been taken down by an attacker because they want to. However, we have an enormously long way to go. When we looked at what happened in the 2016 election, where sensitive emails actually of both parties were compromised, Russia released the ones they got from the Democrats in order to hurt the Democrats, because they felt they would have a more favorable partnership should the Republican candidate win. But the Republican emails were compromised just the same. They just didn't release them. That was a good example of where our entire democratic system was undermined, because what happened after that was, of course, by releasing that information, it influenced the vote or influenced the way that the narrative around the voting process, certainly the way that the whole issue was politicized and then in some cases ignored. It actually set us back a little bit. So I think that you can definitely correlate leadership decisions by administration about what they prioritize. This administration is prioritizing the cyber as a theater of war. The previous administration didn't prioritize as much. I'm not making a political statement. This is not Democrats versus Republicans. This is who spent what money doing what. And this administration's, you know, approaching it a little bit differently. And that is going to pay much better dividends in terms of how will we be able to do in terms of defending our nation, as opposed to some of the decisions that were made in the prior administration. And again, that's not a political statement. That is an objective analysis of how do you defend something by investing in it and by putting the right leaders in place to run those organizations.
I imagine you get to see some fairly startling real-time data, and I'm curious if that real-time data supports the statement that it would be wise to invest in cybersecurity right now.
I'm in. I have an opinion on this. I directly benefit from saying yes to that question. but if we can just for a moment pretend like I don't personally benefit from saying yes. the fundamental truth is I wouldn't have dedicated my life and my career to doing this if I didn't believe this needed to be done and this wasn't worth doing. And so take that with a grain of salt. But the truth is that the attack landscape is constantly changing. The attackers are getting more and more sophisticated. And the way that organizations approach technology by further adopting it, that is only enhancing the target on our backs. And so, yes, my own personal bias aside, investing in security in a way that's relevant to a particular organization, that's an important thing because no one has unlimited resources. But finding the way that's going to deliver the most effective outcome for a specific organization, that is what's going to that definitely needs to be happening. And my bias aside, that is an objective truth.
Now, okay, so we need more people working in it at your skill. Like, clearly you're incredibly talented at this. We need to shore up our numbers, I'm sure, because it's a big job that requires a lot of people. You can't just go, hey, here's all the places to learn it, because you're kind of teaching a bunch of people just a bunch of skills that can be used horribly. How do we end up making sure we end up with the Jedi and not the Sith Lords? Like, how do you go in and actually teach people to do this, but sort of ensure they end up in the right hands? Like, are there training programs to go, okay, and we'll guide you through so that we're teaching you how to apply these this way? Or is it just sort of like a free-for-all and we'll take the best hackers that we find and try and pull them over to the good side?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I had this funny thing happen to me earlier in my career when a buddy of mine, he's a super successful investment banker, and he invests in all these like missiles companies, and like, you know, he invests in war basically. And he hears about what I do and he's like, wait, Ted, you get up on a stage and tell people how things get hacked? He's like, how is that even ethical? There's the bad guys could be in the audience. And the answer is this. Yes, the bad guys are going to learn this stuff too, but the bad guys are definitely going to learn it, and we need to teach it to the good guys. And I believe, and this is more than my belief, it's a fundamental truth, most people are good. Some people are bad. So if we teach everybody and some of the bad people learn how to be bad, they were going to learn how to do it anyway. So the solution is not to not teach the good people. So we need to relentlessly be teaching these ideas and, of course, you know, do the things from when people are children, you know, teach them ethics and morals and all that stuff. But we have to keep teaching everybody, knowing that some bad apples are going to get the information too.
If somebody wanted to go to school to learn how to apply ethical hacking, how to apply their skills towards ethical hacking, is there a program you could recommend?
Yeah, they're popping up all over the place. Our entire company came out of the PhD program at Johns Hopkins, so I certainly have a bias towards that one. But, you know, most programs right now are in their infancy, so they're still kind of figuring it out. But most are going to help give you the guidance that you need.
Okay. Ted Harrington, there are 100,000 other questions I want to ask. And Dave, I can see he's got 100 questions brewing in his mind as well. And I guess the only one that's relevant, given we have 30 seconds left, is can we have you on again sometime?
It would be my pleasure. Yeah. And, you know, for anyone listening, if you want to ask me questions, contact me directly, whatever, just go to tedharrington.com and I'm super responsive.
And if you want to read more about what Ted has to say, Hackable, How to Do the Application Security Right. It's the author of that's Ted's book, Amazon or any bookseller near you. Ted Harrington, executive partner at Independent Security Evaluators. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Webcology today.
Thanks for having me.
Friends, that was Ted Harrington, cybersecurity expert and voice that's going to keep me awake for the next week or so. We got to go. We've gone full circle. We have another show coming right up in the studio. So stay tuned to the network. There's some great programming coming up after this. Remember, we're not out of the COVID woods yet. Keep wearing masks. Keep distancing. Keep yourself and your community safe. We will get our world and our economy back full scale eventually. On behalf of Dave Davies from Weights and Biases, this is Jim Hedger from Digital Always Media. You can listen to Webcology on WMR.fm, recorded live to podcast on the 24th of March, 2022. Stay safe, be well, rank well. We'll talk to you next week.